In the digital economy, what's the role of price when valuable products can be made free? Is there a new business model? How can entrepreneurs benefit?
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We're here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Entrepreneurs never cease to amaze. In their pursuit of the creation of new economic value, not only goods and services, but also new ends and new means and new ways of doing things, new processes, new business models, new markets, entrepreneurs can surprise us and shock us and shift us out of our conventional way of thinking. One example is the developing market for and uses and applications of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a new solution to a problem that's been with us since the dawn of exchange, money we can trust. We can't trust government money because it can be inflated and lose its purchasing power. But we can trust Bitcoin because it can't be deflated, and every transaction can be verified. Can Bitcoin be as useful as paper money? There are plenty of entrepreneurs working hard and working creatively to make that the case for more and more people in more and more situations and transactions. Entrepreneurs will be the ones who find out how useful Bitcoin can be. There's an even deeper fundamental premise to Bitcoin. It's free software. Anyone can load it onto their computer. Anyone can run it. Anyone can initiate a transaction. And this idea on its own, free software, is transformative. And entrepreneurs are investigating the world-changing potential of free software. It has value, as perceived by users, and it has value for the entrepreneurs who produce it. They feel good about their role. They feel good about the quality of the software relative to alternatives. But what about exchange value? We know as a principle of Austrian economics that consumers determine price. But where's the price in free software? Is there a new value model emerging here? Our guest today is Max Hillebrand. He's a free software entrepreneur, contributing to Bitcoin software projects, including WasabiWallet.io. And he applies the Austrian tradition and praxeological reasoning to Bitcoin, the novel sound money of cyberspace. He offers consulting services at towardsliberty.com, and he's easy to find on GitHub and on YouTube via the World Crypto Network, or just search for Max Hillebrand. Max, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Well, thank you, Hunter. It's a great honor to be here. Fun fact, I actually remember February the 15th of 2019, as back in those days, I was seriously addicted to Mises.org and hitting refresh on the website for like the fifth time that day. And all of a sudden, the introduction to economics for entrepreneurs pops in. And I'm like, oh, wow, I love economics. I love entrepreneurs. There's a podcast. What better could there be? So I'm a happy listener since day one, and I'm glad to finally be part in creating this content too.
Well, good. It's our pleasure for you to be here. It's always nice to know that we're communicating some value out there. So, Max, you're a wonderful guest for our podcast because you follow the logic of praxeology to navigate your way through the ultra-modern world of free software and Bitcoin, which is our subject for today. So you're integrating Austrian economics with the cutting-edge emerging concepts of the third decade of the 21st century. We couldn't be more up to date. And that's a wonderful place to be. So let's start there. Tell us how you integrate those things, Austrian economics and free software and Bitcoin. Tell us your thinking about the role of praxeology.
Yeah, the beautiful thing of praxeology is that it's a logical science, right? You start from your axioms, humans act, and they have time preference, right? And from there, you logically deduce. And as long as your axioms are proper, and as long as your logical deduction is correct, your outcome will be correct, right? And that simplifies things tremendously, especially when looking at new technologies, like we have in cyberspace and with the internet. And this is very fundamental because the divergence between meat space and cyberspace, so to say, is very deep in the praxeological reasoning, right? So we start with human action. That means that individuals are in a state of uneasiness and they perceive a better future where these problems are solved and they're no longer suffering. And so they act in order to allocate scarce resources and in order to achieve these ends. And the scarcity of resources is so closely tied into human action, right? It's the self-ownership of your body starts with that. It's a scarce body. That's an exclusivity of who can control it. And it's your exclusive use, right? Nobody else can control your body. So your body is a scarce resource. And so are natural resources, you know, stone, metal ore, lumber. All of these things are exclusive, meaning that only one individual can use them to satisfy his needs. And because of that potential rivalrousness, right, and that potential of conflict, therefore we emerge property rights, as defined so beautifully in the Austrian tradition, with all the consequences that that arises. But the crucial difference between a scarce and a non-scarce good is that a non-scarce good is not exclusive. It is not rivalrous, right? And that is basically information, not just a pattern. The words that I speak to you right now, I don't give them up. I don't need to sacrifice them, but I share them. I get to continue enjoying its use, but you get too, right? And that means that there is no potential conflict, and therefore property rights are not needed for resource allocation. And to make that circle round, free software understands that information is non-scarce and that a property right claim to a certain pattern of information is not just logically contradictory, but it's actually theft of someone else's property, an actual scarce property. And because free software is that spot on with its basic assumption and fundamental reasoning, I think that in the lens of praxeology, it's just beautifully explained.
One of the things you pointed me to look up in history was a group called cypherpunks. And I read the Wikipedia entry on that. But one of the points there was that cryptography and privacy and enhancing technologies are a route to social and political change. So you hinted at that a little bit in your introductory remarks there, Max, but just drill down a little bit to that link to social and political change.
Yeah, the cypherpunks were heroes of the freedom movement in the 1980s and 90s and 2000s and to this day. And their striving was to empower the individual to express himself freely in this realm of cyberspace, right? Or in other words, that you as a user of a computer actually own that computer, right? And you get to decide what non-scarce software runs on your scarce hardware because you own the hardware. Right? But it doesn't mean that you own the software. Software is just zeros and ones. Information cannot be owned. But we can make really cool tricks with information. And one of the things that the cypherpunks kind of pioneered was the use of strong cryptography. And this is just a math formula, basically. We're still in the realm of ideas, right? This is non-scarce goods. But you can use this cryptography effectively to hide a message. Or rather, to selectively reveal, or to choose whom to selectively reveal yourself against, right? So when you have a message and you don't want everyone to read that message, you can encrypt a message to a certain public key from one person, and then only someone with knowledge of that private key can actually decrypt the message. So this is actually the manifestation of free will in accordance with individual property rights of your hardware and in accordance to the non-scarcity of information to just enable free individuals to express themselves freely, which is their natural right.
That's a very hopeful and optimistic line of thought. So I'm infused by that. So let us go into the world of free software, Max. You've talked about its non-scarcity. But also we're talking about building useful tools that people can share and they can adapt. And so we can talk about the free software industry or free software business now. So tell us about that and its size and its scope and where it's going to go.
Yeah, to realize here is that software, just because it's non-scarce, doesn't mean that it's not valuable, right? It's still a good. It still removes your uneasiness. It's still useful to know certain things, right? All types of technology ultimately are ideas. and you need technology in production. So there's still a great need for new technologies, new softwares to come about to solve customer problems more efficiently. And the beautiful thing with free software is that it is very open in its contributory form. Because one of the core principles is that anyone can read the software and anyone can change the software and publish changes of that software. So let's say you're using a certain software tool and it works quite well, but not perfectly. You know, there's some things that you don't really like how it works and there's a problem for you. You can apply your own ingenuity and human creativity to solve that problem and to make the tool just a little bit better. And because everyone is incentivized to just make sure that the tools that he himself uses are well running, that leads to a very great outcome of software. And, you know, that's often known as the scratch your own itch ethos, meaning that that the creators of the software are also the users of the software. And this means that they, as customers, know the problems that they want to have solved, and they know if the tool solves them adequately or not well enough. And this is a great kind of feedback incentivization mechanism where, well, the knowledge or the product creation is at the knowledge frontier.
Well, tell us how it's a business, Mac. So I think of business as I'm generating value, but part of that value is the exchange value. I can exchange it for other goods and services, which is what my aim is in business. So how do we go from free software where anybody can scratch their own itch and improve it to a business?
Well, that's just to realize that a business uses technology always, you know, and information technology specifically. I mean, today there's probably no business that works without a computer, you know, so to have a high quality tool as a businessman is essential, right? And free software has shown to create the highest quality tools. So you as an entrepreneur are incentivized just to use free software in order to solve your problems. And one of the great things is that this software is not just free as in freedom, it's also free as in beer, meaning gratis. So you can use a tool without even paying for it necessarily, just because you can copy the tool from someone else and that other person isn't sacrificing anything, you know, so there's no need for the exchange. In fact, there is no exchange happening. There's just a copying happening of a pattern. But this is, of course, just one side, right? To consume the software that was produced by others in order to satisfy your customer needs in whatever business you're in more adequately. Of course, the other side is to make it a business to produce free software. And that's a complete different business, right? All of a sudden, we're into software development, which of specifically free and open source software. And there are a couple nuances here because, well, with free software, it is gratis. So after you produce it, you know, you just give out the tool that you created for free because you can cheaply and at no cost, basically, at least the publication. But of course, the creation of this product still took a vast amount of time. Writing good software is highly complex and a very nuanced skill set. So there's still a lot of cost involved. And it might not be as obvious how this can be recuperated with a revenue from sale of a product. But again, the value of the entrepreneur is not to sell a product or to even exchange a product. The value of the entrepreneur is to solve a problem for someone else. And free software tools do exactly that. They are very efficient at problem solving for whatever reason you built the software. And therefore, there's still a lot of customer value generated. And therefore, the customer, I would say, is very much willing to give financial contributions back to the free software creator, which we see happening frequently in the space.
Well, tell me how that works, because I'm not familiar with that world, Max. So you're producing free software as an entrepreneur, but you're also getting compensation in return. How does that operate?
Yeah, so there is a small but important difference, right? Meaning that publishing a software or letting other people copy it is not a sacrifice. But spending your own time on developing a certain piece of software very much is a sacrifice of a scarce resource, your time. So this means that there is very much a just market of trading money in exchange for the service of creating a specific software, you know, that either does not yet exist before, or that just needs to be adapted slightly from an existing software. And this is, I would say, the first revenue model, right? To get paid to create tailor-made content or software for one particular person, but after it was created, there's no cost to share it with everyone, right? And that will lead to higher client satisfaction, and therefore, why not share it, right? The other point is of course, rely on donations, right? This actually works to a better or lesser extent for many companies, you know, to have some sort of a foundation where people can donate money to continue the process of furthering the development of this open source project. Now, I think this is a very interesting approach, and you know, the gratuitous gifts are quite common, especially in a free market society. So I think that this is, to a certain extent, a useful strategy as well. But of course, it is, you know, relying on donations is, it's not as optimal as it could be, right?
Uncertain.
But it's very uncertain, exactly. But I think many people would be surprised with the amount of value that people receive from the use of free software, and that, well, I guess their human generosity really leads them to want to contribute back. And this contribution back, sure, it can be of monetary value, and that's very useful because, well, money is liquid and you can buy stuff with it. But the majority of these contributions back to the project are usually in terms of time and talent and skill, right? So if one of the users loves the tool that he's using, but he sees that there's a small problem and that he could potentially improve it, well, then he's incentivized to contribute back because he's already achieved a lot of value from this project. So bringing some back is still a good exchange for him.
Yeah, it's back to the concept that we're all entrepreneurial on both the producer side and the consumer side. Both acts are entrepreneurial. Well, you operate in that world, Max. You operate successfully. What can you tell us about your journey and what your experience has been that people can learn from?
Oh, that's a very great question. Because I'm so razor-focused on the praxeological method, and because I do understand the difference between scarce and non-scarce goods so deeply, it really was challenging to find a proper way to get paid while doing the work that I do. You know, because let's take, for example, you know, creating video content. That's similar to software, as video is just another non-scarce good. And for example, with this podcast here as well, right? Right now, we don't really get paid for doing the show, right? Customers don't send money before the podcast, right? So it's just free to download. People can get the information whenever and wherever they want. And an easy way to get paid would be to put it behind a paywall, right? So to say that, well, if you want me to publish this information to you directly, right, then you need to pay me some money. And I mean, that's all right, because ultimately, you're doing something here. So if you only want to do it, if you want to get paid, that's all right. But the big downside, of course, is that it limits your audience, right? It limits your potential customers that you want to reach in this educational venture. And therefore, it decreases the utility. You know, it's no longer as impactful as it could be. Now, maybe that's a good thing in some smaller scale projects, but oftentimes you do want to reach as many customers as possible. So then a paywall doesn't make sense. I think one of the really fascinating models that has been articulated in the last couple of years is this value for value model, which is especially proliferate in the podcasting industry. And here it is that the content itself is still shared freely to anyone, just on your podcasting server. But as inside your podcasting RSS feed, so inside this data structure, you put your Bitcoin Lightning Network public key, basically an address where people can pay you. Let's get a bit more into the details of this later. But the cool thing is that now users or listeners of your podcast can choose to voluntarily send any amount of money back to you for every minute that they're listening to this podcast. And this is just truly fascinating, because it still appreciates the non-scarcity of information. We're not trying to restrict the freedom of flow of information, but we ask the user or the customer to actually pay back as much as he thought it to be valuable, somewhat similar to a donation. But in the user experience of these new podcasting applications, this is done automatically in the background, right? So as soon as you hit play, you send 100 sats per minute that you're listening. And as soon as you hit pause, the payment stops to flow, right? So it's a very interactive, very dynamic experience that makes this kind of donation flow much more real time to the actual receiving of the value. And I think you see that especially with something like this boost function. So instead of sending a payment per minute, you can send a one-time payment whenever, when there's something interestingly set on the podcast. So right now, if listeners are already on a podcasting 2.0 enabled wallet, you know, they might smash boost right now because they like this particular section of the content. And that's fascinating because I can also receive the statistics of when my users actually hit the boost button and gave me some extra sats for this content. So it's an actual market feedback mechanism with the let's say profit, with a somewhat similar profit motive, you know, that you actually get rewarded for producing quality content that the listeners appreciate enough in order to actually pay you for it.
Yeah, the value for value exchange is the essence of Austrian economics, because we believe that value is subjective on the consumption side. What is deemed to be valuable on the production side by entrepreneurs is also subjective. And so the value for value exchange is an expression or a test of that proposition. So it's an interesting development. We're all becoming more Austrian.
Yeah, it's very true. And you know, you're surprised how much your customers value the products that you produce. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you give them the opportunity to pay as much as they want, basically, the amounts that, I mean, many users, of course, sent in less than you would have expected, but a handful of users will send in exponentially more than you could have ever dreamed of. And that's a really interesting way to get paid for the production of non-scarce goods, which I do think that we have to tackle in a separate analysis. Austrian economics explains you beautifully how to produce scarce resources, you know, and how to allocate that. But I think that in the production of non-scarce resources, we really have to challenge our thinking and apply the same reasoning, but while taking still care to the nuances.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's MISES.org/E4BPod, and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah, there's an old definition of economics. It actually came from Lionel Robbins, who used to be an Austrian before he wasn't. And it's about the allocation of resources in conditions of scarcity. And we've got to ditch that now. That's just not what economics is about. But that's a subject for another day. You've introduced Bitcoin, Max. Thank you. And that's free software. It lets individuals working together create rules of monetary transactions. Anybody can write a transaction on the blockchain. It's permissionless in that sense. It's free to use. There's no trusted third party. So transition us into Bitcoin as free software and the implications of that.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is yet another tool of cyberspace, you know, just a bunch of zeros and ones that run on your computer and magically solve a problem. And the problem that Bitcoin is engineered and designed to solve is that of money, roughly speaking. And this is a very old problem of the internet. In fact, going back to the cypherpunks, they were very important in the early creation of not just the internet, but also in the early attempts of creating digital money. And the main problem of these early approaches, all the way back to 1983, where Chom proposed eCash, this was a way to make transactions infinitely fast, infinitely cheap, and extremely private. The privacy of these systems was second to none, to this day, incredible. But the major downside was that the verification of transactions and the enforcement of the rules of this system were left to a single trusted third party, the issuer of this token, so to say. And that never worked, because sooner or later, there will be, well, either a fault of that central party, you know, maybe the software they run has a bug, or maybe they just go bankrupt and stop running the software, or, you know, a private person hacks into their servers and, you know, destroys it all, or, of course, a state comes in and shuts down their business, which all of these have happened numerous times to all of these central definitions, verifications, and enforcements of monetary rules. And now the genius of Bitcoin was not to figure out how to make transactions digitally. That's easy. What Satoshi figured out was how to verify the transactions of a network. And even more so, he figured that it's not just important that it's being verified. It's important who verifies it. Mm-hmm. Because whoever does that has a huge amount of control over that network. And so in Bitcoin, he separates two distinct classes of humans, of entrepreneurs, who provide the security of the Bitcoin system. Because ultimately, as with any technology, the security is ultimately always a human-based, right? Someone needs to use the security tool in order for security to be established. So in Bitcoin, these two groups are, for one, merchants. And merchants are the entities who define the monetary rules that they are running onto their own hardware. Right. So this basically means nowadays you just download the official software of Bitcoin and you run it. Right. This is by downloading and installing and running that software, you're clearly defining for yourself under which conditions a coin is to be true. And these include, for example, that there should never be more than 21 million Bitcoin, right? Or that you always need to have a coin before you can spend it, right? Or that when you want to spend a coin, there always needs to be a signature attached to it, a valid signature. So all of these rules are defined in the software package and you define them for yourself. In the next step, you connect to a network of other merchants, other people who are running a similar type of software, and you ask them, which transactions do you think are valid? Right? So you are asking another entrepreneur to give you his set of transactions that, according to the rules of that particular merchant, are valid. But notice, you're not asking for him to send you the rules. Right? You're just asking to send him the result of the rule verifications, mm-hmm. right? The valid transactions, according to him. But you don't just trust that person blindly. That would be stupid. You verify that for yourself. So you go through all of these transactions that were given to you by other people, and you check if they're actually correct or not, according to your own definitions. If yes, great, you keep that transaction and you consider it valid. And you continue talking to that other merchant trying to get new transactions. But if you find out that this transaction is actually false, you know, that it tries to spend 42 million Bitcoin, for example, then you reject this transaction from your own computer. To your own computer, you just delete the information, basically. And you block the connection to that Bitcoin full node that was sending you that false transaction. So here you're basically defining, verifying, and enforcing your monetary set of rules. And the reason why this is only done by merchants and why I specifically use that term is because that if you're just running the software and checking the economic transactions of someone else, right, so Alice bought pizza from Bob, you know, that doesn't interest me. So I don't really enforce anything here. The point where the enforcement comes is when a merchant at the point of sale you know, offers two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin. And he then receives those Bitcoin and he checks if that receiving Bitcoin transaction is actually accurate. And only when it is, does he hand over his pizza. So the properties of the money and the hardness of Bitcoin, meaning that there are only 21 million Bitcoin, this is only protected and enforced by the merchants who run a Bitcoin full node and offer their goods and services in exchange. This is where the protection of Bitcoin's hard money supply comes from entrepreneurs verifying the money in exchange for their goods and services.
Yep. So that's a great connection, Max, to entrepreneurs. And you said that more and more profit-seeking entrepreneurs are going to choose to get paid in Bitcoin, hold their cash reserve in Bitcoin, and denominate their contract in Bitcoin. And you've emphasized that it's important to separate those three or understand them as equal components of the future of Bitcoin. Can you just emphasize that for us a little bit?
Yes. So the first part is to get paid in Bitcoin, meaning that, you know, you have goods and services, the two pizzas, and now you want to provide them to a customer. And of course, you want to get rewarded from the customer for the value that you have generated for him. And you do that with money, right? So the ability to get paid for the work and goods and services that you provide is essential for any entrepreneur. And it's just that in the current fiat banking technology, this is heavily censored. There are millions, if not billions, of people who do not have access to a bank account, right? And who cannot accept these digital new medias of exchange in fiat for their goods and services. So they're effectively prohibited from being an entrepreneur, you know, at least in cyberspace. Of course, everyone can accept cash. But even here, that's of course, makes it difficult. So to get paid in Bitcoin means to have a censorship-resistant way of getting the value retribution from your consumer or from your customer, right? So there's nobody that can stop the customer from paying you. Not even you can stop the customer from paying you, to be honest, because Bitcoin is this push system where anyone can send money to anyone. So to use Bitcoin to get paid just means that you will never have to worry about your bank account getting shut down and about no longer being able to get paid from your customers. Or, of course, second step is then to hold your cash reserve in Bitcoin, right? So after you have given away your goods in exchange for the money, now you have a question of how much of that new capital should I save and how much should I invest? To save money means to save capital basically means to hold it in an asset without counterparty risk, so to say. Right? And that is relevantly base money. You know, a gold coin is base money. It's not a claim on something else. You know, it is the thing. And same with Bitcoin. If you hold a Bitcoin, nobody else has a claim to it. And you don't have to give that Bitcoin to someone else. It's just yours. You know, so this is a counterparty risk-free base money. And importantly, it does not have an interest rate, right? Because there is no counterparty risk. And that is your savings rate. Now, the investment rate is, of course, how much of that saved capital do you then invest into businesses, ventures with counterparty risk and with potential interest and profit to be returned, right? So that can be any debt contract, equity contract, raw resources, labor, all the production goods and consumption goods. You can invest in those. Now, why would you want to hold a cash reserve, a savings rate? Well, because the future is uncertain. You might not yet know the problems that you have tomorrow. You might not yet know exactly what you feel like to eat tomorrow. You know, is it pizza or is it steak? So that's why you don't yet pre-buy the pizza for tomorrow, because maybe you want to have steak. And so holding a cash reserve without counterparty risk means that you can at any time sell that good on the market for an entrepreneur for any goods or service that he might offer to you. So holding money means to remove the uneasiness of what to buy when in the future. And therefore, it's essential. You know, without a savings rate, there would be no capital accumulation and no production and therefore no consumption. Right? So savings rate is where it all starts. And the problem, of course, is when holding a savings rate in the fiat system, that it gets inflated. Now, inflation, of course, being the increase of the base money supply, it's been crazily rapid. You know, over 56% inflation rate in the global base money supply in 2020, and another 36% just in the first half of 2021. You know, the fiat base money supply is hyperinflating, meaning that your savings are getting diluted. That's, of course, a big problem. You want to protect yourself against from that. Of course, the best thing to do that is Bitcoin, which is a money that you as a merchant define the money supply of. And you're not going to cheat yourself, right? So Bitcoin protects your cash reserve, the second part. And finally, and that's the kind of last stage, is to denominate your contracts in Bitcoin. And this is important for a more subtler reason, right? To get paid censorship resistantly in Bitcoin is obvious. To hold your money in non-inflatable, your wealth in non-inflatable money is obvious. But why should you denominate your contracts in that? Well, this is basically to understand the Austrian business cycle. And that when you increase the money supply, not just do you dilute your savings and prices increase, that's a consequence. But the real causal effect here is the early stage reasoning is the malinvestment in ever deeper production stages. And the reason why this waves out into the deep cycles of the economy is because all contracts are denominated in fiat. And after the inflation, they only slowly start to adjust as the newly printed money trickles down the economy. So when more and more entrepreneurs denominate their contracts in Bitcoin, meaning a stable monetary asset that cannot be inflated, that cannot be confiscated, then the Cantillon effect and the resulting Austrian business cycle theory are simply eliminated. But this can only be the case if the contracts are actually denominated in Bitcoin. And that's why it's such an important step. And so ultimately, these three things really make this entire thing so exciting for entrepreneurs and for merchants. But of course, it's a stepping path, right? You don't have to do all of these things at once. It will take time and courage, of course, to do so. But it is possible. I am at a point where I demand to exclusively get paid in Bitcoin. I have neither a bank account, and nor do I want to get paid in fiat whatsoever. I hold all of my cash reserve in Bitcoin. Lately, it's much less gold than it used to be. And I also do denominate all my contracts, especially debt contracts, in Bitcoin. So it is possible, although, of course, still early.
Well, that's a very practical approach, Max. And you've introduced me, and I'd like to introduce some of our listeners now, to a number of tools that are available right now. They're very practical for entrepreneurs. They apply to all aspects of the entrepreneurial process. So when you mention a couple of them at your discretion, also talk about the use cases. You said there's some fabulous use cases for some of these tools.
Yeah, so the one to highlight here, especially because this is an entrepreneurship podcast, is BTC Pay Server. This is a phenomenal tool that basically builds a website where you can easily configure how to get paid and for what. So this is a tool that runs a Bitcoin full node, right, on your server, meaning, again, you define, verify, and enforce your monetary rules. But in addition to that, it's basically very easy to create a website that has Bitcoin payment requests nicely integrated. So this can be, you know, as simple as a small button that you can put anywhere on your website that just says pay me in Bitcoin, and you click it and it pops up this QR code with the Bitcoin address. Or this can be a point of sale application, you know, where you have this calculator view and you type in $25 and the server automatically calculates how much Bitcoin is that, you know, and creates the invoice and, you know, registers email addresses and all of this. Or for example, you can import your category or your catalog of products that you have for sale. You know, a coffee, espresso, macchiato, pizza, all these things. And you add pictures to them, you know, small descriptions. And now anyone can visit your public website in this cafe and just select the items that you want to pay for. And voila, it is paid. So this is a incredibly helpful tool that I use to get paid for basically everything now. Whenever I issue someone an invoice, it is directly in BTC Pay Server. And I get an email when it's confirmed. And again, everything is automatically verified. And I can sleep at peace knowing that nobody is trying to give me fake gold here.
Good. So that's the real world today.
Yes, exactly. And
Good.
one additional cool thing about BTC Pay Server is the integration of the Bitcoin Lightning Network. And this is a network that kind of sits on top of Bitcoin. It builds on top of the axiom that is Bitcoin, so to say. And it is basically a smart contracting platform designed for creating micropayments denominated in Bitcoin. A bit of a buzzword, but the smart contracts involved are basic multi-signature schemes. And this, or the beauty of it is that we can make payments without having to rely that everybody in the Bitcoin network verifies them. Because that's an inherent issue, right? That's the scalability issue. If every merchant ought to verify every single transaction from every other merchant, that's just not going to scale. That's going to be very costly. But that's how the Bitcoin blockchain works. You need to verify every transaction since the Genesis block of 2009.
Yeah, every time.
Yeah. And the idea of Lightning Network is to find a cryptodynamically secure way to make a payment without needing to tell everyone else. And this is done by utilizing these so-called payment channels, where two parties collaboratively create this new Bitcoin address where they have this partial ownership over. And then with partial signatures of transactions off-chain, so to say, these two parties can now communicate and shift the value inside their channel from left to right. So let's say Hunter and I want to collaborate on this Lightning channel, and I put one Bitcoin of my own money into this Lightning Network channel. Now, later, I can start sending, you know, 0.01 Bitcoin to Hunter. But this transaction where I'm sending this, so the first transaction, which I'm sending my one Bitcoin into this multi-sig address of the Lightning channel, that is publicly verified by everyone. But then every subsequent transaction, you know, when I want to send you 0.01 Bitcoin every hour, all of these subsequent transactions, we just talk to each other. But because of the cryptographic verification that you're doing on each of these transactions, you know that you can at any time publish this latest state of the transaction to the Bitcoin network for verification. So ultimately, you know, you publish the first transaction, then we do 500 transactions off chain, and later we settle and we do another public transaction on the blockchain that everyone must verify, where we close the channel with the amount that each of us agrees upon. And this is probably a bit too complexly explained, but the gist of it is almost instant, extremely cheap payments that can be of tiny size. And again, opening up so many new use cases for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, Saifedean Ammous says that's the future of Bitcoin, the way we should think of it, that most of the micropayments or small payments will take place off-chain on the Lightning Network or something like it. And then Bitcoin proper will be reserved for the transference, often the international or global transference of very large sums where the speed and security of blockchain or of Bitcoin are appropriate. So you and he are saying the same thing. So mention a couple more tools, Max, just so that people can explore. I'd like to emphasize this idea of tools that are available for entrepreneurs right now.
Yes. So, I mean, hopefully by now your listeners have set up their own Bitcoin node and their own Lightning node and their own BTC Pay server. And what you can do now, especially if you're a podcaster, as I mentioned earlier, it's very easy to get paid from your listeners directly via the Bitcoin Lightning Network for all the podcasts that you do. And for this, you can go to valueforvalue.io, which is in a small website that will guide you through how to set up a wallet and then connect this to your podcasting RSS feed. And this, it is really something to behold. I encourage every podcaster out there to try it out. But I now get, you know, every day a couple notifications that someone sent me a couple hundred or thousand sats. And I don't know who it is. You know, I just know that he valued the work that I did and the non-scarce knowledge that I shared with him. It's really something. And sure, this is now implemented for podcasts, but the same idea works for music, you know, or for movies. Or, of course, many other things. The general groundbreaking thing is that we found a way to do these secure micropayment transactions. You know, if, for example, if you are a software company that sells API call access, you know, you have some data set and people call your server to get some data. Now, every time they make this API call, how about you tell them, well, give me 10 sats, you know, a small amount of Bitcoin, just so, and after you do that, I will give you the, I will give you this data. You know, we can have, you know, parking meters charging from the car directly for every minute that it is standing on the parking spot. And as soon as the car leaves, you know, the payment stops. The amount of new customer demands that can be satisfied when we have unstoppable and instant base money trade is absolutely staggering. I mean, again, we have here a money without counterparty risk. How many business models are currently not working because all digital payments rely on counterparty risk? Credit card fraud is rampant. It's absolutely ridiculous because trusted third parties are security holes. And now all these awesome ideas that we had, where we were only missing a good money in cyberspace, well, that can be done now, especially with Bitcoin and the Lightning Network.
Good. Well, Max, let's move towards summing up. You've introduced us to a lot of great concepts here, and I suspect you'll be back to tell us more about some of those. But I get this picture that there's a new world emerging. We're at the beginning of it. It's not the future. It's now. The elements we've talked about are free software, Bitcoin, and I didn't get to mention the book. We'll do that another time, but we love a book called Crypto Economics by, say the name of the author again because I can't pronounce it, Eric Voskuhl. Right?
Exactly.
Okay, we'll link to that because there's a terrific combination there of Austrian economics and Bitcoin, and he calls that crypto economics. So we've got opening up pathways to new kinds of entrepreneurship, new markets, new money, and maybe even people operating on new values, new personal values in this secure and no counterparty world. So just give us your summing up of what you see in the immediate future, what the possibilities are.
I really believe that the possibilities are quite substantial. And that is because our current situation is quite dire. 100 years of fiat regime and hyperinflation of monetary base is not a good thing. And well, we tried to end the Fed, but that didn't work so far with political campaign. But I am very confident that with Bitcoin, we can simply defund the state and the Fed, meaning that it's taxation simply becomes no longer possible on the two vectors of capital controls, meaning transaction censorship, and inflation, meaning, well, theft. So Bitcoin is this genius tool that entrepreneurs can use today that is proven to protect property rights in an undisputed fashion. Not a single Bitcoin was spent without providing a valid signature. In this small context, there has never been a single theft of Bitcoin, which is absolutely staggering. The levels of protection of capital that is now afforded to entrepreneurs because of Bitcoin is staggering. And the amount of unleashed potential of new customer values that we can discover and seek to satisfy is absolutely staggering. And I'm struggling to really articulate this because I would really encourage all great Austrian entrepreneurs that are listening to your podcast to really consider to adopt free software and Bitcoin, not just because it is the most suitable solution, but also because of the fundamental ethical values that underlie both of these systems and that they are just so eloquently explained in Austrian economics. And there are, precisely because there's this infinite realm of possibility all of a sudden opening up, we simply don't have enough entrepreneurs satisfying all customer demands. There is a massive and absolutely staggering amount of underserved customers out there that are just waiting for entrepreneurs to come and fix problems. And I do believe that especially now with a hard money that entrepreneurs can use to protect their capital and to more rationally allocate it in the deeper production stages, that the possible consequences of this are indescribable. So Hunter, again, I'm very thankful for having this conversation with you here. And I will love to continue listening to your show. And hopefully soon you too have the value for value enabled. And then I can stream you some sats for the amazing knowledge that you share with us all. So thank you, Hunter.
Well, Max, thank you. I now have a very specific to-do list that you've generated in this conversation. I hope a lot of people listening are also jotting down a to-do list. You made a very practical connection between free software, Bitcoin, and entrepreneurship. And I'm sure you can help us again. So thank you so much for this introduction and mind-opening set of information that you've given us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Hunter. It was my pleasure.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.